Cool. That says recording.
Nice.
Will I kick off?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. My name's Magnus Davidson. I am a research associate at the Environmental Research Institute based at UHI North Highland. And I'm also a director of Community Land Scotland, as well as being involved with other organisations based at a community level here in Caithness. I'm joined by...
I'm Gus. I'm a self-employed ecologist. I mostly do sort of habitat and botanical surveys all across the Highlands. Yeah, and I'm also a director of Reforesting Scotland and a trustee of Scotland the Big Picture. So very much involved in rewilding and ecological restoration and all of that sort of stuff.
You said the magic word there, rewilding. And so I think it's probably fair to say that I would be the repeopler here and you will be the rewilder. But yeah, we absolutely understand and respect and are proponents of each other's positions. So
there's a lot of crossover.
Yeah, I'm a real crossover. Real proponent of rewilding as well, and you're a real proponent of repeopling as well. And what we want to probably discuss today is how we see those integrating together through this landscape here that we call home in the North Highlands.
Quite a bonny landscape it is.
Yeah.
Very diverse, and you know, people, I'm sure there's a lot of people who'd say there's a lot wrong with it, but you know, you've got to start with something. And I'd say we're starting with something pretty spectacular. So
we spent some time this morning out walking in this landscape, like we've done before, and maybe worth beginning with saying kind of what makes this landscape special to each of us. And I think that might be quite an interesting approach, to hear what we value in the landscape and what we see in the landscape, and maybe elaborate a little bit more on these positions that we've outlined when it comes to repeopling or rewilding or a mix thereof.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say personally, I'm very much a sort of plant person. So, but then again, I'm interested in birds and all sorts of other stuff. So just wildlife in general. And I mean, some of the wildlife in the North Highlands of Scotland is just like world class. You know, we've got certain species here that you don't find anywhere else, and or in very few places elsewhere in the world. So finding them is always spectacular. But just generally sort of the day-to-day stuff you see that's out there all the time, you know, you'd say maybe it's common out here, but you know, other places in the world, in Scotland anyway, it's not terribly common. So I don't want to use the word wild because it's not a wilderness, you know, by any means, as we'll discuss. Like, people have been part of it for a long time, and people say wilderness is not aligned with people. I don't know, whatever. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a very sort of like, it's good. It's got a lot of nature. I'll sort of put it that way. And so going out and seeing all these species and knowing that they're all still there, despite the state that the world's in, you know, there's a lot of hope out there in that all these species are still there, despite quite a lot of adversity, not only from people, but just generally from existence. And yeah, they're all out there just waiting to be seen, or perhaps waiting for conditions to be a little bit better for them. So yeah, I very much admire the sort of natural heritage of the area. That's my sort of main...
For me, it's absolutely... I can respect the natural aspect of the environment and very much appreciate it. Probably I don't have the sophistication or knowledge to be able to appreciate it to the same extent that you can. But for me, it's the peopled aspect of this landscape, or in many cases, the peopled aspect to depeopled landscapes. So for me, it's absolutely, I think, interesting to call it wild when it comes to biodiversity, but not when it comes to human impacts, for example. So where we were walking today, there was the Cana Catnach, the old Sutherland man pass for the drove roads for cattle, and we went and visited or walked past an old house, and then there was the Clearance Township across the river, and then we visited the sites of the Shielings, and that kind of sums up to me what makes these landscapes special is that they feel homely. And I certainly feel home, at home in these kind of landscapes. And many people, again, did feel at home in these landscapes. But the point around the starting position is super interesting, because you're right, these are in a lot better condition, albeit we can talk about this being in bad condition, but it's in a lot better condition elsewhere. And when I was driving out today, in fact, we drove past Curley, like I was saying, and there's a lot of people all across the rest of Scotland who would be absolutely delighted at the opportunity of seeing the Curley.
Especially right by the road.
Exactly, you know? And it's just a normal occurrence. The last time I'd driven that road, there was actually, I saw the Curley, maybe it was the same Curley, but the Curley there. And so, yeah, it's a really, but the main thing for me is that, yeah, these wild landscapes are homely landscapes as well, and I just love being at home in these landscapes.
Just adding on to what you were saying about, you know, you're seeing these places where people lived, and I don't think you said it, but, you know, the prospect that people can live here is obviously something that you really enjoy. And what I like about that is that I know that people could live there too. And alongside people living there, we can absolutely have even more wildlife, and, you know, nature will hugely benefit from having more people there who actually live in the landscape, not people who, I don't know, come out and go for a walk or whatever. These are people who live and work. And, you know, here we were slating the word remote because, you know, remote from what? I mean, if you live out there and you've got internet connection, you can live out there and have a job, you know. So,
connect with the whole of the rest of the world to do that. The almost, I overuse this phrase, but people not just in the landscape, but of the landscape, and whereby you're connected to that landscape through working it, and working it being in a really broad sense. That work in the landscape could be work in the landscape by rewilding it or restoring it. But yeah, having that connection to the landscape rather than just sitting in a house and not being connected to it in any way. The another point that I always come back to is that, and it touches really nicely on your point around the internet connection, but going back, when people were living in this landscape, they were doing it in a sustainable way, and the absence of people is when the degradation came, when it came to the clearance and it came to then the introduction of the sheep, which we know stripped a lot of natural capital out the ground, led to drainage, then led to deer, the overgrazing problem with deer.
And yeah, alongside every one of these things are some of the crucial things that are impacting biodiversity across, especially these sort of, you know, peatland landscapes in Scotland. So
These land use changes have all been facilitated by the removal of people. And that's not to say that if we were to reintroduce people back into these landscapes, that we would have to reintroduce them into an 18th century subsistence lifestyle, when we have things like the internet. We have fascinating ways of building buildings these days and off-grid. And we've been talking about this as well, when it comes to who goes back to live in these landscapes, and whether the people who go back to live in these landscapes can live in these landscapes sustainably. And we used the examples of ourselves. We are two people who would entirely enjoy going back and living in these landscapes, and we are people who I think would leave these landscapes or these areas that we lived in a better condition than we were to find them in.
And I don't think that's us being sort of self-righteous or anything. I think most people would, you know, most people, once you get somebody, it's the same anywhere. If somebody lives somewhere, they generally care about it more. So if you have people out there living in that landscape, they're gonna get to know it, they're gonna learn about it, they're gonna want it to be in a better state. And in terms of where we were today, it would be, you know, blocking those drains and, you know, culling the deer, and especially if that's done in a community sense, you know, it's I mean, venison's got to be one of the most sustainable meats out there, especially if it's come from, you know, your back garden pretty much. So, just so much scope for getting people, as you say, of the landscape, and as a result, nature just taking off. And then us reaping the benefits from nature taking off. It's a sort of, I wouldn't want to say vicious cycle, it's a sort of positive. Very friendly, positive cycle. Yeah, so...
So what's the barriers that are in place to realising this? Because we can sit around the table and go for a lovely walk in the morning in the peatlands of the Flow Country and come back and sit and talk about this. Some people would call it a utopian vision, but what are the barriers that we have in place? And for me, the first one, which I would lay above anything else, is land ownership. We don't have ownership of the land. And so we can enact these positive changes which we would like to see in the landscape. And without having access to the... Well, we have access to land, but we don't have the ownership of the land to be able to undertake this. And the ownership of this land is generally in the hands of very few people, quite often absentee, which means they don't have that connection to the landscape. They're not of the landscape. And they quite often have it for reasons... beyond what we were talking around. They want to have it as a hobby, or they want to have it as a trophy piece, or they want to have it as an income generator. Anything really apart from calling it home.
Yeah, and... I've forgotten where I was going to go with that. it's a shame, and especially... No, I've forgotten where I was going with that. Oh, you hit a really good note there, and I've forgotten what it was. What was it you were saying there?
When it came to being land ownership of the landscape, absenteeism, not having ownership of the land.
It's gone.
You can cut this out, but...
Yeah, cut this bit out. that's really annoying. I continue anyway.
So when it comes to... So that's potentially... That's really barriers to the landscape of people being in the landscape. How about barriers to, say, the ecological restoration or the rewilding or the restoration in these landscapes? What barriers exist at the moment?
Well, I'd say probably to lead on from your point about people not being... in the landscape as a result of, you know, the land ownership, I think a lot of people, instead of, because they're not of the land, they go there and visit it. So they're not, part of it. They're not part of it. They don't go there to be in nature. They go there to visit nature. And then they come back to wherever it is they live. Whereas, if they were out there and lived in it, then they'd just be far more of a connection, which then I think leads on to where there's a barrier in terms of ecological restoration, is that people don't know their landscape that well. People are so far removed from, well, not really far removed. I think people are getting far more clued up on how it all works, you know, especially, I don't know, social media has probably got a big part to play in that. But I think just over time, people are going to become more aware of some of the issues that are going on. But most folk are quite far removed from exactly what's going on in the landscape. So you're not going to get the sort of pressure or as much pressure from people because they don't know to apply the pressure to whoever it is that owns the land. Those people who own the land basically get to do what they want with it. You know, there's very little restriction as to what they can and can't do with it.
Going back to your point around people visiting the landscape and not being of the landscape, do you think this comes back to the problem that we have in conservation where we draw barriers and draw lines, SSSIs or SACs, around areas and we say, okay, that's for nature and not for people, and this area is for people and arguably not for nature? Do you think that we need to blur those lines and break some of those boundaries down? I've been studying something called convivial conservation, and that's effectively what it is. It's removing these barriers making the lines between nature and people much more fluid, and putting people into wilder spaces and pulling the wild back into peopled spaces. And it's an approach that I think is really interesting and would work incredibly well here. But yeah, it almost makes me feel that this fortress conservation that we are living through at the moment and predates both of us as generally quite young guys, it just seems to me that this isn't working very well, drawing lines around areas and saying that's for nature, that not for people. We're not in a very good state after, what, decades and decades of living like that.
Well, I mean, simply put, yes. I agree, yeah, completely blur those lines, get rid of them, in fact. And I think that's, like, part. I mean, you know, everybody has their different vision or version of rewilding, but that's definitely a strong part of mine, is that nature should be everywhere. It shouldn't be, we've got nature reserves and that's where the nature is. It should be, nature should be in your garden, it should be in the farms, it should be on your houses, it should be, you know, all sorts of places. It should be everywhere. And that's, you know, just part of a healthy planet, really. When you're drawing lines around triple SIs, I can think of a site of special scientific interest over in West Sutherland, where you can very clearly see which bit is designated because there's a fence around it, and it's a perfectly square block, and the biodiversity in that block of it's mostly birchwood with some hazel and some other nice stuff that you would have far more extensively across the whole of the Highlands. Just the biodiversity in that little block far outcompetes any of the sort of surrounding hillside that it's on. But yeah, as you say, if you blur that line, get rid of that deer fence basically, and let that birchwood spread, then you've just got far, far more nature basically. But the thing there that's stopping that from happening is the surrounding land use is dominated by somebody who just wants high deer numbers so they can shoot deer semi-easily, I think. Fortunately, that particular area, things are changing very slowly, and you know, that's good, but it's only because this one person has decided that this several thousand hectare estate, they now want to manage it this way. But it's entirely, as far as I'm concerned, entirely unsustainable, because, you know, whoever succeeds them goes, I want these deer back. And that's it, you know, you're back to square one. Whereas if you had a far more diverse land ownership pattern, you know, more people are owning smaller parcels of land, one person changes their decision and says, I don't want trees in this bit, you're only affecting that tiny little parcel of land. And that's where I see a huge boon for nature in terms of land reform, is that there's going to be far more space for it, because you're not blanketing an entire landscape with one person's idea of how they want it to be managed.
I find the approach to land reform refreshing, because it becomes democratic then and socially just is another way I would approach it. But it's quite an interesting point that you perceive as a barrier at times here when it comes to landscape scale restoration being under the hands of one person, others might see as an opportunity, that it's only one person that we need to convince to enact change over this whole landscape scale. And I know that's where there then at times is an appreciation between, say, some in the rewilding community and the current concentrated land system that we've got in Scotland working well together. You've laid out pretty well why you think that that's not the best approach, and I think I would entirely agree with you. And in fact, it goes back to some of the work done by the Land Commission that effectively said you don't actually need concentrated land ownership over a landscape scale to be able to enact landscape scale change. And I always go back to that, because I think it's really useful to remind ourselves that you don't need one landowner to be able to do some really good work. And then you look at things like Cairngorms Connect, or you look at the Afric Highlands, and some of these humongous restoration or rewilding projects are being undertaken with multiple landowners, public, private, third sector. And I think that's really a really interesting approach. Where do you think that we need to go when it comes to land ownership for us to realise this vision that we see?
Just to sort of back up what you're saying, I've read about sort of rewilding projects, whatever you want to call them, in Spain, and one of their biggest barriers was that they were trying to convince, you know, they couldn't, unlike in Scotland where you go to one person and say, you know, that we think this is a good idea, and either they say yes or they say no. If they say yes, you've got a huge landscape to play with, whereas in this place in Spain, it's lots of, you know, small landowners, so they're having to approach heaps of farmers, but generally they didn't actually have to enact much change because the landscape's already pretty diverse. But in terms of Scotland, I mean, from what I've seen, I, especially this year, having seen certain places where there's a lot more community ownership, just it's so enlightening because you can see kind of what I was outlining already happening, you know, because it's more voices in a community sense. It's more sustainable because, you know, you've got people in the community now are going to hand on to the rest of whoever it is that takes on the community in the future. So the vision stays reasonably stable. I think community is definitely the way to go, especially the way that the world is going now. People are just so clued up on what we need to do with the land. And yeah, I think if you're handing it more to more people to have, you know, that obviously comes with its struggles because you're never going to please everybody. But in general, I think most people want more nature and healthier landscapes. So handing it to communities, state ownership works very well as well, as long as the state is doing what people really sort of are wanting from the landscape, rather than what they're being maybe told they want from the, or need from the landscape. Certainly community ownership, just in this last year I've seen a few examples and I've gone, wow, it actually does work.
Yeah,
you know, it's not all the way there, you know, there's teething problems very early on in that whole process, but already, you know, I'm going, oh, okay, so this does work.
I'm a proponent of community-owned land for a multitude of reasons, not least because of the work that can be done when it comes to climate mitigation and adaptation. Community Land Scotland released a report saying exactly this. And again, going back to my point on democratic ownership of land and socially just ownership of land, community ownership, I think, ticks all of the boxes of what I want to see out of land ownership, which... And I don't know of any other ownership type which ticks all of those boxes. When it comes to private ownership, I have no problem with private ownership, just not on this humongous, concentrated scale that we've got. We need lots more small-scale private ownership. I think that's a nice approach. The state ownership question is really interesting, because I would agree with you that it's fine so long as the state's doing good work, but at times they don't. Some of the assets that they own, say, and they're getting better, and a lot of what's been done has been decades old. But when it comes to like Forestry Land Scotland, I think that estate could be managed in a lot better ways. And we have a remote seat of government here. I'm going to use the word remote. Our government is, we've got two governments. Both of them are hundreds and hundreds of miles in the south, far removed from the communities here in the north of Scotland. And they do, they get a lot right, but they also get some things wrong. And I would like to pull that ownership and control of the land much more closer to the people in and of the landscape. And even then, it comes back to the government, for example, own crofting estates here in a very benign way. But can you consider actually there may be absentee landowners as well? Mm. On the crofting note, you like trees, and I'm growing to like trees more, and I took you to see a couple of trees today, a couple of aspen and some rowan, which had managed to escape the grazing of the deer by clinging to the side of the river. And we were talking around woodland crofts because, well, it goes back to your point on community ownership. Community owners are really the ones who are developing the woodland croft approach and model at the minute and creating new woodland crofts, if we think in places like in Mull. And it's something that's really attractive as a land use type for both of us. Talk me through why you like woodland crofts so much.
I think it goes back to people being in and of the landscape. You know, as you said, working the land. And there's a lot of work to be done, you know. I mean if you own a woodland croft and you want to grow trees for money, you're probably not going to grow a block of Sitka spruce. You know, you'll probably grow some because there's obviously money in it, but you won't want to do that with the land that you're actually living on. You don't want to see a big block of Sitka spruce on your land. It's going to be far more diverse, far more sustainable, less intensive. And there's all sorts of other stuff that comes with that, you know, the wildlife that will sneak in around the edges. I mean, I say sneak in, it will come bounding in if you're not managing the landscape too intensively. And there's also all sorts of stuff to be said for the community that then develops around that. You know, one person might have a wood mill, which then the rest of the community can own. One person might get a sort of slaughterhouse built on their land, and that you get a community slaughterhouse, so this meat isn't travelling all the way down to, I don't know where the nearest
Dingwall.
One, Dingwall, yeah, all the way down to there just to be sold back in Thurso or wherever it is. There's just so much to be said for it. As you say, bringing that control, but not only the control, but everything that's produced in that landscape, bringing it and not having to send it way miles away, because all of that, all the facilities are there in that landscape, provided by different people in the community who are all working towards basically being able to live off the landscape. And as I say, you know, people generally, if they live somewhere, they care about it and want to maintain it nicely. So they're probably going to look after it, probably for wildlife in many cases. Yeah, and as you said earlier, us two, maybe, you know, the fact that if we were living out on that bog, we'd want to see it in a better condition. I think the people who'd be drawn to living in places like that are the sorts of people who are going to want to improve it. And I think that will become, you know, maybe in the early days as a relatively select bunch of folk who are happy to do that. But if we can get it to that point, as it becomes more popular, more people are going to be drawn to that. And I mean, especially post-COVID, the number of people moving away from cities and realizing that actually don't need to live in a city to work because I can work from home. And, you know, there's far more flexible ways of working these days. And, you know, you go inside and do your graphic design stuff on your laptop, and then you pop out to cut down a couple Sitka spruce to harvest and send away to the wood lathe up the road, and then lathe some wood panels, and it's just, yeah. I mean, it's funny because I'm finding myself talking far more about community as the person who's supposed to be the sort of ecologist who's, you know, really intent on the plants, but it's because I can see not just the plants, all the wildlife, but it's because I can see so much. You know, I'm putting forward the vision of the people, but that's because in my head at the same time, I'm seeing everything that's going along with that. You know, you've maybe got some coppiced hazel, but you're going to have some hazel that you just leave, and you'll get loads of nice lichens on it in the West Coast. And you know, you'll have some stands of oak that's maybe managed for like timber. You're going to get your wood warblers back. In the pine woods, you'll have capercaillion, especially in places, you know, I'm trying to think. There was an example down, this isn't in the North Highlands, but it's something that could be replicated here. I've forgotten the name of it now. Comrie Croft, that I was mentioning, you know, half that site's pretty, you know, they've got people camping there. They've got mountain bike trails, they've got a cafe, they've got a farm. The other half of that site, they pretty much leave alone just to be, you know, burnt wood and to regenerate into nice woodland. And, you know, maybe they stick some cattle in there occasionally just to diversify it. If that was the balance across the whole of Scotland, absolutely no problem at all, you know. Half of it being people living in and of the land, getting, you know, making loads of business from it. I mean, the number of people supported by that little site is incredible. But then, you know, half the site is basically left for nature. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, it could work so nicely. But yeah, as you say, there are barriers. And in terms of, you know, change, I think one of the reasons that I don't want to go as far as saying anti-big landowners, because, you know, some of them are doing great things for nature, and it is good to see the general way of land management changing. But I think especially, you know, both us two being young, as you mentioned, I mean, you talk about echo chambers, but all of my friends want to see a landscape where it's not all owned by one person. We want to be part of the landscape. And I mean, none of us can afford houses.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can't even live relatively near the landscapes that we want to live in. So to be able to see that change in the future, you know, that's what I'm seeing my generation as wanting, is more diverse land ownership. So if we now, whoever we are who want ecological restoration, can also push for more diverse land ownership at the same time, or at least be very much sort of wedded to the idea almost, then in the future it's all going to work out better for both of us.
Yeah. I live in town, you live in town.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a really interesting point. We can't afford, or we don't have access to living in these environments that we would like to live in. Woodland crofting, or even just crofting, allows that to happen. So the creation of the croft, and for me it's much more around crofting tenancy than being an owner, but again, I can understand why people would want to buy their crofts. And then that allows access to land, which then allows access also to things like croft house grants, and for building houses and really building a future and a livelihood in the landscape that's a net positive for the environment, for community, for culture. And it ticks all these boxes. For me, there's a really interesting point too around the creation of new woodland crofts on old monocultures or clear fell sites. And that for me is around not seeing existing crofts being put under trees, for example. Now, I know people do this, and I can understand why they do it, but I was actually speaking with a local crofter who was decrying the thought of putting this croft, which had generations and generations had toiled to improve, only to put trees under it. So I'm really attracted to the approach of new woodland crofts on these sites. That's not to say I don't think existing crofts should be managed in a different way. I would love to see them become more productive, potentially not just used as in-by land for keeping sheep on. Crofts used to be way more productive back in the day. People used to grow food on them. Again, just not keeping sheep on them. I can understand again why we're in a position now where that's mainly what they're used for. But yeah, just coming, it's this, we're young people. Housing is the biggest issue for us living in the Highlands. As young people, I don't own my own home. I would like to own a home in this landscape, which can put down roots. There's the Gaelic concept of duchas, for example. It's the landscapes here in the North Highlands is the landscapes which, for me, my forebears called home.
But nowadays, yeah, many people would say they're empty.
Yeah, emptied. That's what I would say.
The thing, yeah.
And And in fact, the reason that I live in Thurso today, or one of the reasons I live in Thurso today, is because my forebears were cleared from that inland landscape to the coastal towns, Thurso and Wick. It's just a... There's a vision, and we know where we want to get to, but we're struggling to be able to get to that point because of these barriers in place.
And I think there's also... money obviously is quite a big thing, and one of the barriers, I think, in terms of land ownership, you know, coming to community land ownership, you think about the price of land nowadays, and this is quite a lot driven by carbon offsetting, and there's a sort of almost a case in point of how it's unequal. It's not all about equality there, really, because that money, you know, I do a lot of work on peatlands, and I'm sort of, jaded, is that the word? I need the work, and it's nice that I'm getting employed to work in these landscapes, and, you know, it's sustaining, like, a rural job, if you like, which is nice, but the money that pays for me to do these surveys comes from the public purse. That is the survey is done for generally a large landowner who's getting his peatland, which has been destroyed over centuries of relative abuse by the feet of sheep and deer.
A land use change which is enacted by the landowner, usually a him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's getting this survey paid for by the public purse to restore a landscape that maybe he hasn't done, but generations before him has been responsible for. He gets the public purse to pay for it, or he gets it paid for through another scheme, and then he can sell carbon credits and get money from big businesses who are offsetting their carbon emissions elsewhere. And all that money is staying in this tight little loop at the top, which is a lot of money in this tight little loop, but the bigger loop that sort of sits below it just isn't getting this money, and that bigger loop is got more people in it, basically. So it'd be really nice to be able to bring that money into all these other people in the bigger loop. And to do that, we need to basically bring these two loops together so that the money that's coming for carbon offsetting, whether carbon offsetting is a good thing or a bad thing, perhaps out with the scope of this sort of discussion. But to bring that money into community hands, basically, allow them to do more with it. I feel they do far more with it than it's doing sitting in the pockets of these very few landowners.
With Scotland's concentrated land ownership, of which the scale is worse, arguably, in the North Highlands because of the large estates, we are going to be funneling a huge amount of taxpayer money to a very small number of individuals if we pay for ecological restoration through public purse. So things like Peatland Action, for example, or Forestry Grant Scheme, for example, rather than the codes. And that's, I just find that preposterous. That's not a just transition.
No, that's unjust. Yeah. That's about the definition of unjust. It's more money going to the people who already own the land, like a heap of the land. And, in some cases, this is funding them to then do whatever it is that they want to do with perhaps the rest of the land. If they fenced off this bit for woodland, they can do even more of whatever it was they were doing before. It's potentially perpetuating some cases bad practice. And the other thing about this, as you were mentioning, crofts going under trees, I think that's very much come as a result of the way we're approaching this whole carbon offsetting rush, is that the approach is plant loads of trees and restore loads of peat, whereas if you're in a more diverse landscape that's being managed by people who understand the way that the landscape works, you know, the ecosystems and how everything works, and they're gaining things from that, particularly in this case, venison, then you're not going to need to plant these trees because your little relict woodlands are going to expand from where they are. That's like a fact. That's going to happen when they're relieved of this pressure. And as a result, you know, you wouldn't need to plant trees on crofts because all the surrounding landscape should be quite well wooded anyway. And then, you know, these crofts would probably become even, you know, hotspots of sort of biodiversity where, especially if you're managing them perhaps with cattle and pigs rather than just sheep, which, as you said, you can understand why it perhaps has gone that way in some places. Cattle and pigs do great things for biodiversity, so it all slots together very nicely, but it's so long as you've not got this overarching intensive land ownership, yeah, almost, whereby, yeah, as I say, one person is effectively choosing what to do over a massive scale.
You raise the question, or you raise the point there around cattle, and we walked the old drove road today past the shealings and the shealing huts where people would live in the summer with the cattle. And then we looked out over a hill that was called Badnam Bo, the place of the cow. That is quite an opposite understanding of how many people in the conservation community or ecological community or the peatland community would view these landscapes. They view them as wild. But if we go back 200 years ago, these places were used by people, and I would argue in quite a sustainable way. You're going up there for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks at a time to use the land and rotate the cattle across the land. You're not sitting there maintaining huge amounts of deer numbers or sheep numbers year round and year round. I'm not arguing for returning to living in a peat or turf shealing hut through the summer, but some of these practices can be undertaken again. When we were talking around technology and internet, GPS collars that come to cattle these days, like, I would love to see somebody, and I know there's people, crofters, and still that are using GPS to get cattle back onto the moor. But I would love to see in that landscape that we were in today, more cattle back, fewer deer numbers, more people back, fewer sheep numbers, more drains being blocked and the peatland being restored, more trees. I mean, that's
fewer spreading Sitka spruce.
Sitka spruce. That maybe brings us back to a really interesting point, that the non-native, or the spread of the non-native Sitka spruce into the bog landscape is a bad thing, bad environmentally. And it's not been tackled because it's a hard challenge. Mainly issues around who's responsible for the spread of non-native, how you deal with it, the labour intensity of having to deal with it, who pays for it, where does that funding, how does a funding mechanism look? It's an obvious one for me, is that you parcel up some of that land, you give a land use tenancy to somebody to then manage that land. You don't even need to sell that land. You can just create an agricultural, or what the Scottish government's talking around with the new land reform bill, a land use tenancy that allows somebody like you or I to manage a small area of peatland where we can go in. We don't mind spending our Saturday mornings going in and pulling out a few Sitka spruce because, one, we care for the landscape. We hopefully want to be in and of that landscape. But we also could share some of the benefits, whether it's just having some land which we can spend time on, whether it's being able to shoot deer, whether or not it's being able to take a share of those carbon credits. But something like that is just such an obvious example for me, is, okay, we have an environmental and ecological problem that's going to get worse. The most obvious solution is to put people back onto that land to deal with it. It's maybe that's where the Scottish government's going with the new land reform bill and land use tenancies.
And just on that point, I mean, you know, we've already kind of covered the biggest barrier, But it leads on. It's the same kind of thing with this consultation that you mentioned. I don't know if it's going to get the engagement that I wish it got, because I don't think people understand how good they could have it, you know, how nice it could be if people were back in the landscape, you know. I mean, we could, I don't know, certainly in our circles, I'm sure if we said to somebody, if you could get Wi-Fi and you could live out here, would you live out here? Most of our friends would probably say yes, but you go to maybe the general public, they'd go, no, it's so remote and far from this and the pub and all that kind of stuff. And I think there's just that general disconnect in Scottish society. Perhaps less so, yeah, probably less so up in the North Highlands, but a disconnect between people realising that they should be part of the landscape, you know, and so is this consultation going to get the engagement it should do? I don't know. I hope it does. I really hope it does. I know I've got the tab open on my laptop ready to send away my sort of response to it, but...
No, it's an interesting point. I was walking in the peatlands with my two stepchildren a number of years ago. And so they would have been, I don't know, 10 and 12 or 12 and 14 or whatever. And I said, and we were walking in an old cleared township. And I said to them, would you live here? And they said, no. And my heart kind of sank a little bit. And I said, why not? And they said, there's no internet. I said, if there was internet, would you live here? And they said, absolutely. And I think I repeated the same kind of question to my partner recently. And I think I was met with a similar response, which I always find interesting.
Maybe and you did it again with a group of young folk that I'm part of. And obviously we're all involved in sort of ecology and conservation and everything. But yeah. I mean, that was a group of how many of us? I think it was like 12 or 13 of us or something. And all of us were like, yep, absolutely. And, you know, you put the people there and the facilities start popping up themselves. Yeah. You know, okay, you go out there and obviously there's no pub out there, but that's going to come as the community develops. And I mean, even in sort of hubs of, like relative hubs of, residential areas in the Highlands, a lot of these are really like dying off, you know. Yeah. There's young people are having to leave because there's no work for them there. And, you know, houses are going empty and ending up becoming Airbnbs or second homes, and the community is dying, basically. There's no two ways about it, really. And, you know, I want to be a young person who's part of a community. I can find that where I am in Inverness. But I want to be out in you know, the Scottish Highlands, in the North Highlands. It would be fantastic.
My home here in Thurso, I am part of an incredible community. The part of town I live in, it's just something that I feel at home there. I find it, it's just, I can't praise it highly enough. I want that in this landscape as well. I want what I've got there. And there's no reason that can't be had. It's existed all across the Highlands and the North Highlands here for hundreds, thousands of years. It's just over the last 100, 150, 200 years that's been lacking from this landscape. And we, it goes back again, it's this modern interpretation of community and of ecology and of people and culture. And we can have it. There's just some of these barriers, land ownership, lack of support from government, for example.
And the drawing arbitrary lines between people and nature.
Nature.
I mean, these landscapes, some of the, you'll be more clued up on which ones are designated and which ones aren't, but they're designated as wild land areas, are they not? So what does that mean? Does that mean it's, you know, you're not allowed to put up turbines and you can't have roads and all this kind of stuff? And you go, well, why not? Are we just valuing emptiness?
Yeah.
You know, we're putting value and designating emptiness, like a lack of people. And it's not the way it's been. As you say, you know, that's what, 100, 150, 200 years. Ecologically speaking, that's a relative little, that's not even a blink of the eye. That's nothing. And yet it's caused so much probable decline in you know, in people and nature. So why now are we now perpetuating what has become a sort of denuded landscape in so many ways by saying, oh, we value this because it's wild?
Yeah.
In quote unquote.
We are lucky that with wild land areas, of which we were walking in today, have not been designated. But is that the way that we're going to go in the future if people like you and I can't make the case for blurring these lines? And I think it's up to people like you and I and our peer group and our friends and our colleagues to be able to do this, to be able to say, look, this is another way that things can be done. And then I think it's communities with the support of government who need to take that and say, yeah, let's try it, let's do it. Like Comrie Croft, for example, and to showcase and create this kind of wider societal change, which we really need to see.
But again, it goes back to, you know, you pointing out that the places of power are so far removed from here. You know, I could get one of these MPs and say and take them out for a walk, and it would probably all make perfect sense to them. But their priorities probably lie to where they're based. Or priorities probably lie in where they're based,
yeah,
which is far away from here. You know, getting them to enact these changes is harder because they are removed from it. So, yeah, there's... what comes first? I don't know where we go first, really, but I think, as you say, banging that drum and making sure that people do see how it could be and the benefits, and as you say, finding these examples of, you know, they're small scale relatively, but when you sort of increase the scale that they're working on, I think the benefits are going to be, it's going to be incremental. It's going to be, it's going to be far more benefit at a larger scale than there is at this current sort of small scale that things are having to work at, just because of the way the system currently is.
We should probably think about rounding up now, but I'll pose a question and I'll probably answer it first. Is where, what would you like to see of some of these denuded ecologically and socially landscapes in the year 2050, for example, because so many climate targets rest on that date? For me, it would be, again, seeing people back in these landscapes living, and almost, what are we in 20, that could almost be second generation people living in those landscapes. It could be living in those landscapes, but in a really ecologically minded manner. People in the landscape enhancing the landscape. And that could mean a huge amount of work to begin with, culling deer, pulling out Sitka spruce that's been spread in. But actually, maybe by the year 2050, it's a hands-off, relaxed approach. Or it could be the management of that next generation of woodland, the native woodland. It could be building on the success of the last 30 years and applying it beyond into the whole area. It, for me, it certainly means having really interesting communities with more kids, with schools, socially diverse, multicultural. We might, by the year 2050, be especially privileged to live in areas like this because of climate refugees, for example. It would be really nice if we were in the position to welcome people to our landscapes here, introduce new cultures and new people to the landscape that we've got here, because we've managed to create a landscape which is more robust to climate change, more adapted. Hopefully we won't see huge amounts of that, but I would like to think that we could be in a position where we could open our hands and welcome people into these landscapes.
I don't know where, I don't know what I can add to that, honestly. I think in terms of, I'll go slightly more specific, but for me, I like woodland. I think we've got pathetically little of it in Scotland. And, you know, people talk about woodland, they think of trees, but a woodland is so much more than trees. And so the way we're approaching woodland at the moment is we're planting, we bring in some fencing contractors to this landscape that's owned by one person who's decided, all right, I'll put some trees there so that I get some carbon money for it. Or perhaps they've got genuine motives to create woodland for wildlife. So currently we bring in these fencing contractors, stick up a fence because, you know, dealing with those deer is far too much of an effort and, you know, you'd have to pay a bunch of people to come in and do it. Stick up the fence, those people leave, so they're not part of the landscape anymore. You bring in your tree planters, you plant these trees, and then they leave. And then that sits there, and that's it. Your landscape's back to no people in it. And inevitably, as I've seen across virtually the whole of Scotland, the fence will fail. The trees might get to a certain size. The fence fails, deer get in, and you've basically got a few scrappy trees on wet heath or dry heath, and you're not actually developing a proper wooded ecosystem, which is what the majority of Scotland would be. It would be a forest ecosystem. It doesn't mean it's all forest, because obviously out here, as we've seen, this is a lot of blanket bog. There would be so many more trees, though, naturally. So what I'd like to see is people living on that landscape, managing it constantly, because, you know, it's a constant effort thing, bringing these deer numbers down. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems in Scotland, you know, in terms of sort of, you know, land management issues. People need to live in that landscape and be there constantly. And then you're going to see trees popping up themselves. Trees are going to regenerate. You're not going to need to go out and plant them and then and leave it for a while. And alongside that comes a whole host of other management issues, because, you know, you'll have certain areas, you don't want everywhere to be trees, you want some areas to be grassland, you want some areas to be a sort of wet heath or flushes or whatever, so you're going to have people grazing those bits with cattle, you're going to have somebody with their horses in this bit, you maybe have some pigs in here, and yeah, it's just a far, you know, it's not only the sort of, you know, the ecology, like the plant ecology or the biodiversity ecology, but it's the human ecology that comes with that. All the communities, everything fitting together, not in the sort of disjunct, clunky, kind of ineffectual way that it currently is, which is demonstrated by the catastrophic biodiversity decline. I mean, we're one of the least biodiverse places, nations in the whole planet. And as you say, if we can start now, as soon as possible, by the time it gets to 2050, we will have a far more resilient landscape. You know, I'm seeing out in deer forests where people rely, you know, the few people who are employed by that ground, basically, are having their jobs put at risk because heather beetle is coming in and destroying swathes of heather, which is the main thing that the deer can eat, because they've basically eaten everything else. Whereas if you've got a diverse ecosystem, it doesn't matter that the beetles come in and knock out some of the heather, because you've got blaberry there, you've got young trees, you've got some willow, you've got nice grassland, you've got all that sort of stuff. That person's job is going to be sustained because there are still deer there. And I don't want to get rid of sport shooting. I want to see a system that works for itself. You know, it's not requiring massive inputs, which is what we unfortunately probably are going to have to put in initially. But once we've taken that step of getting people in the landscape and putting in place management structures across the landscape, it should all just sort of tick along quite nicely.
And on that note, I think we can finish up.
Yeah, I think so.